Radio.
All I wanted to do when I was in that bed recovering from surgery was be an athlete. And I took that pursuit once I got out and didn't take it really for granted. I just made sure I got out there, I trained, I worked hard, because you never know when you're going to end up back in that bed.
Hey y'all, I'm Ryan Devlin, and welcome to the Struggle Climbing Show, where I talk with elite climbers about their struggles and breakthroughs in training, nutrition, tactics, and mental game. Now today we're chalking up for a chat with an incredibly accomplished climber and one of the most driven and resilient athletes that I've ever had on the show here, Ben Mayforth. Now you probably know him as his Instagram handle, Crushing Benjamin, and crush he does. As a competitive climber, y'all, Ben has appeared on the podium at every USAC Nationals he's attended, and just this past weekend continued that streak with a bronze medal for a super strong performance on the wall. He's also scored silver at 3 IFSC World Championships and 2 Paraclimbing World Cups, and he scored the top spot, that's right, gold, on the podium at 2 World Cups. Ben is a superstar in the paraclimbing world, and by the way, will burn most able-bodied crushers off of their climbs as he campuses their V double digit with that trademark smile on his face. He's doing big things and has even bigger goals indoors and out, and while he probably wouldn't approve of me using the word inspiring to describe his climbing, even though he is, by the way, instead, I'm going to use the word motivating here, because this guy has had more than his fair share of struggle, but rather than keep him down, it seems to fuel him. Ben is an accomplished competitor, athlete, coach, and mentor, and today's conversation will no doubt leave you a more educated and psyched climber. All right, what's going on in my world here for a quick second? I was out on the project again just this past weekend. Amazing weather, brought the kids out there. And the good news is I'm starting to feel that fitness return after taking a couple of months off to train predominantly on the moonboard and just like hang out with my family and eat donuts. There's this new donut shop down the road from my house, you guys, that is making some ridiculous flavors. Red Velvet right now is currently holding the top spot, but Churro is a close second. I digress. Anyway, I'm putting in more days now on rock now that the conditions are really nice out there, and that means putting in more whips as I try to gain fitness and also just suss out that final bolt of the route that I started projecting last fall. Whip after whip after whip, which makes me really happy, y'all, to announce that Maxim Ropes have come aboard to support the show, and man, do I love their ropes. I had the chance to give them all a test drive this past fall on my route, in fact, when I was working it with Maxim athletes Jordan Cannon and Eric Hurst, and now I have got an airliner of my own. And I'm telling you, it is hands down the nicest rope that I have ever tied into. The 9.1 millimeter Maxim airliner is ultra light and skinny, but that featherweight doesn't sacrifice an ounce of performance, y'all. It is frequently referred to as the indestructible airliner due to its longevity, which is awesome for a few reasons. In fact, first, peace of mind. So, like, I struggle with fear of falling, and some days, you know, it's worse than others, but it's always kind of in the back of my mind. And so I just want full confidence that my rope has got me. And the airliner from Maxim, which is triple certified, goes above and beyond in that department. Second, I don't want to have to shell out for a new rope every season. And the good news here is that Maxim goes the distance, which also means that it has a smaller impact on our environment, which is really great. And then lastly, the airliner is so dang light, it makes the approach a breeze, and it feeds through my gear incredibly smoothly, so I can save all of that energy to flail around on my project. Not Maxim's fault, but I'm working on it. Look, if you guys are looking for a super lightweight, ultra-thin, and extremely durable cord, you have found it. It's made in Massachusetts, and it's available at your local gear shop or online. You can check out the specs, the colors, and all of the other ropes that Maxim offers by hitting that link in your show notes, or just swinging over to thestruggleclimbingshow.com/Maxim. This episode is supported by Koros, a fitness watch that was made for climbers. Y'all, I've been using their Apex 2 Pro, which, by the way, you've probably seen on the wrists of former guests Tommy Caldwell, Sasha DeJulian, and Stefano Gisolfi, just to name a few. And I'm telling you, it's really changed how I look at my training and my recovery. Honestly, it's just the best wearable tech on the market when it comes to supporting us climbers. A lot of the stuff out there has no idea how to handle climbers and what we do with our workouts. I mean, check this out. It has a feature that'll auto-detect the pitches that you're climbing in the gym or out on rock, and then you can log the grade of those. You can program all sorts of workouts in there, including hangboard workouts with timers built in. And then with all the biometrics that it analyzes, it's really helping me to optimize my training and my performance. So if you like to geek out over your training, and if you're busy like I am, I think Coros could be pretty revolutionary for you. You can hit that link in your notes or swing over to thestruggleclimbingshow.com/Coros. And you can also, by the way, score yourself a free watch band with a purchase of an Apex 2 Pro using code STRUGGLE at checkout. And lastly, just a big, big thanks to all you patrons and subscribers out there. I love you so much. I just dropped a fantastic bonus episode for you with Ben, and I'll tell you all more about that in a little bit here. But first, let's crush with Ben Mayforth.
Half of my projects are covered under snow at the moment, so.
Yeah, exactly. We have to be patient this time of year.
I have a very small weather window, and unfortunately, both weather windows are either during the comp season or during my festival season.
Yeah. Is that Little Cottonwood that you get out to?
I get out to Big, but more so, I'm really trying to project stuff at American Fork right now.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I've never been out
For ropes, and then for boulders, I go to Joe's. I'm working Resident Evil at the moment.
Sick, dude.
Yeah.
That's awesome. How often do you get out there?
I got out there a couple times in December, January, but I haven't been out there since my work schedule or like boyfriend, girlfriend stuff with Mansa has taken over some of my projecting time.
Yeah. Well, dude, you're a busy guy. I'm grateful that you're able to carve out a bit of time here for us to connect. You sound great. The levels look good. So I think we'll just dive right in. Why don't we start where we always start, Ben, which is struggle. And what does struggle mean to you as a climber?
Struggle's kind of a life model. But especially in climbing, struggle's really, I would say it braces the physical aspects for me more. Mm-hmm. And some of the mental aspects, obviously, like if you've seen my climbing, I struggle with footwork quite often. And so trying to adapt around what ability I actually have with my feet and what ability I don't have with my feet. That's the big struggle in making sure I'm the most efficient. So especially in my transition as I'm going from boulder to a sport climber or boulder to a trad climber, the big struggle is like making sure I'm trusting my feet because I typically don't feel below my knees. I don't get the same power that I get that normal climbers get out of their dynos. Like I got to transfer all my power around my upper body and my core. Mm-hmm. Trying to achieve some of the goals that I want to achieve does come from a very big struggle with incorporating good footwork and efficient movement with my feet. I've done a good job of it over the years, but it's definitely a struggle.
Yeah, and I'm excited to explore some of that specifically kind of in the technique and like tactics chapter because I struggle with footwork too, but certainly on a different level than yourself. But maybe it's, you know, helpful. Although I'll have introduced you in this episode, and many people listening right now are going to be very familiar with you as a climber from seeing you on the world stage in comps or just like your mind-blowing videos that you've got on the board or on projects. However, not everyone will be familiar with it and maybe aren't familiar with your condition as well. And is it spina bifida that you were born with?
Yeah. So I have spina bifida, so it affects... My overall diagnosis is much greater. It's called Bader syndrome. Mm-hmm. And so that means there is something wrong with every major system in my body. So my neurological is affected by spina bifida. My skeletal system is affected by scoliosis. My urinary tract system is affected by conjoining issues with spina bifida and having one kidney. I have a rib deformity in which my right liver is completely exposed, and yet there's no rib cage for my lats to attach onto. So it attaches onto this like weird tiny spot on my spine. And for some reason, the muscle grew. It's actually quite a large medical phenomenon. They've actually written papers on why this is not actually possible.
Wow.
And they don't understand how I can still generate force out of my right side just because of that rib deformity. It's a miracle. It's a bloody miracle. I can generate so much force campusing with a missing rib cage.
I mean, you just don't half-ass anything, Ben. There's something wrong with every part of your body. You're like, oh, I'm not just going to do just the muscular system, not just the skeleton, literally something with everything, dude. That's intense.
Yeah, and it was a very, I think that's where the real struggle began. I've had over 29 surgeries.
Wow.
And a lot of them, I wasn't sure if I was waking up on the other side because they were so severe and so massive that I had no idea what was going to come around.
Was this mainly when in your youth?
Yeah, so zero. And I think my last surgery was right as I was 20. And that was an emergency one. And that one scared the crap out of me because I knew people that had died from that condition.
Wow.
Like, and I knew two or three people that had passed due to, it was an entangled bowel situation. And you're, body just goes septic and they take you on the, most people don't make it off the table. That one scared me quite a bit. Made it through. They only took them an hour. Took my guts out, put them back in. Nothing was wrong. They just fixed it up real quick. Something was wrong.
And that was your 29th surgery?
That was my 29th surgery.
Holy smokes, dude. And that's a different level of struggle to kind of to look through than we typically would on this show when we're talking with athletes who are, it's more of an elective struggle, right? That we enter into this conversation, but you bring a much richer history of dealing with physical and mental and emotional struggle. And so I think we should spend a little bit more time on this if you're willing to, because going through that, especially when you're younger, has no choice but to impact who you are and how how you develop as an athlete, but also just as a person. And what stands out through all of those very challenging experiences? How do you think it's created Ben Mayforth as we see him today?
It's unfortunately created a pattern of behaviors that makes me seek struggle and seek suffer more.
Really?
Because it's familiar. I've been around, growing up around my disability my whole entire life, growing up around fighting through surgeries and stuff like that. So I have this constant anxiety and these ups and downs where like I'm waiting for the next struggle to begin. And so it doesn't allow me to like fully enjoy life sometimes. So like the big one, the three big ones all happened within 6 months of each other. In 2005 and 2006, I went through three major back surgeries with 2 months of recovery between. Otherwise, my spine was growing at such a weird rate and had such a weird curve that they said if my spine grew any further in, it was almost 90 degrees curved.
Wow. Is that considered scoliosis or is that just spina bifida?
Scoliosis and like spina bifida with like a shortened leg, that's a pretty common thing. And so I didn't use a wheelchair until 2006 and I just walked around everywhere. So imagine like a kid limping everywhere with no supported spine, a missing rib cage, and one leg shorter over a certain amount of years. That spine just kept going this way, this way, this way, this
right.
way, to the point where it was almost 90 degrees. So they had to go in, they had to detether my spine. So with spina bifida occulta, which is the subcategory I have, you get a lot of tethered spinal cords. So there's parts of our spinal cords that are just floating in our spinal column, like tentacles, and they get wrapped up a little bit and they get tangled, and surgeons got to go in there, cut some things up and make sure that they're good and that they still send signals. Unfortunately, the last time I had that done, they nicked a nerve that they did not anticipate, and now I have no plantar or pointer flexion.
Wow. Which one would think would be pretty important when it comes to rock climbing?
It's pretty important. I can't really toe down whatsoever. I have feeling back, but it's still not functional. I can tell temperature, and that's about it. I used to be able, I had movement in it, things worked better, but it just all shut off. after a while.
You've obviously faced in your years much more adversity than most people in the world ever will, but you're also an elite athlete and you played Division I wheelchair basketball. And
yeah.
You are competing at the highest levels as an adaptive climber. And by the way, just as a fucking climber, like, you know, I mean, you outclimb most able-bodied climbers out there. So although you've faced significant challenges physically and emotionally, mentally, which we can dig into in more depth as we work through these chapters, you continue to come back. You continue to put yourself, as you said, into these positions where you're almost seeking out struggle. And why is that?
I think it's just one of those nature things. Like, I study psychology and I would say it's a sad moment, but it's also a productive moment at the same time. I'm still seeking the same amount of, like, I think I more realized it recently when I was in Bozeman. This, I got the screaming barfies and I started laughing.
Oh, wow.
Like, I hear people complain about this and I'm like, this is what you people complain about? This is nothing. This is bullshit. I'm laughing my butt off, gagging the whole time. I'm like, this is nothing. I've had rods put in my spine. And I think it's, you're looking for that. I liked ice climbing a little too much because of that, where it kind of reminded me that you do struggle. And it's like that sad circumstance of someone going back to the same thing that caused them trauma over and over again, because it's familiar. We already know what that's going to feel like. And I think the good amount of the physical struggle for me is I went through so much physical and mental struggle my whole entire life. And then when I was becoming an athlete, all I wanted to do when I was in that bed recovering from surgery was be an athlete and go explore how my body works. And I took that pursuit once I got out and didn't take it really for granted. I just made sure I got out there, I trained, I worked hard, because you never know when you're going to end up back in that bed. So I wanted to make sure that if that time came, I was in as good a shape as possible. That way I could recover quicker, but also remind myself constantly while I'm training that, hey, you don't always have all the time in the world. And I've calmed down on that timeline quite a bit as I've gotten older, because some of my expectations don't meet reality sometimes. But every day I go in and train, I'm like thinking about, I don't know the next time I'm going to become that helpless again. And I wanted to make sure I took advantage of all the time I could and still can while I'm healthy.
Yeah, really appreciate you sharing that perspective. And it certainly does put things into perspective, I think, not just for you, but for people who are listening, as we get into our elective struggles of rock climbing that we're passionate about and that are very real. And there can be incredible disappointment and heartbreak and also really huge victories. But through the lens of some of the other struggles that you've been through, I think that perspective can be very important and offers up a very nice segue here as you were talking about getting into training, because we can dive into our training chapter and just kind of nerd out for a little bit here, because not only are you an elite athlete, but you are also a coach and you've conducted many clinics and you mentor climbers. So I'm excited to get your insights here in the training chapter, but we'll start where we always do, which is struggle. And so where do you personally struggle when it comes to training?
Getting started. It's always a little bit of like making sure I have the right motivation or the right timeline to get started. When I go and train, I typically don't come home. So like I'll go straight from work to the gym and go train while I'm there, kind of snack in the car or snack once I get there so that I have enough calories to go through everything. And then I'll get right into it as quickly as possible. But warming up usually takes quite a while. It's like trying to get the engine started. It's like going out and warming up your truck like 3 or 4 times.
Yeah.
Before everything kind of feels good. In terms of training, it's more along the lines of getting started. And rope, sometimes, depending on the day, rope climb, getting started on ropes or slab can be like one of the hardest things for me to actually hone in on, because most of the time I'm like, I don't really want to focus on that today. I want to have fun with my training. But it's also the struggle of like going towards the things that you are very uncomfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
So those are my two main struggles with training, is like getting started and then going towards the things that I'm not good at. I've gotten a lot better at like that. I'll go towards slab usually first thing right off the bat now, just to get it out of the way and just get things moving, get the blood flow back into my legs. So that's been the big struggle for me training wise.
When you're talking about kind of the way that you're structuring that time in the gym, is it built around comp training?
Then, yeah, like, it's built around comp movement training. So most of the time I'm looking for specific movements that I will typically see in a comp route that are difficult for me.
Sure.
Which tend to be the more techy moves. The powerful moves aren't going to be what's hard for me anymore.
You got plenty of power.
Yeah. Now it's more finding the technique and the actual movement types that I need to focus on that I'll see. Because as I've gone through the years, the movement types have gotten significantly harder, with a lot of weight rocking, a lot of weight shifting, making sure you can actually rock up on your foot or shift all your weight. And so like I can grab a crimp and hold on to a crimp like no other. But if I have to mantle off a sloper or have a high foot and stand up on a high foot, that's where my limits kind of stop me. So like I'm really focusing on trying to find those specific movements that have shut me down for the last 4 years of competition climbing. So I'm specifically looking for those weird body positions that I don't like to get in.
Yeah, good for you. I think one of the things that separates the elite from the casual, the amateur, the weekend warrior, is that there's an ability to get after weaknesses and really kind of live in that discomfort. Whereas maybe for myself, when I go to the gym, I try to work everything, but I'm more susceptible to being the gravitational pull of the things that I'm pretty good at. So, you know, good for you on going for that. I mean, one of your strengths, as you just juxtapose those two things, is your finger strength, your crimp strength, your upper body in general. I've seen you campus stuff on the Kilter board that I can't even touch the holds on. And so I'm curious if that finger strength, that grip strength, was developed as a result of using a wheelchair or something you've trained, or maybe you just are genetically predisposed to having like really strong grip. And how much has that impacted you, you know, your climbing?
Yeah, I think it's more of just like something that I've developed over the years, that like straight up hand strength. I grew up around contractors and mechanics all the time. So like for fun, we would just pick up bricks type of deal. Like,
right.
Even from a young age, I was picking up bricks like this.
Yeah.
Because that's the only way I could carry it with my body. I couldn't bring my body here. I would always have to stand up and pinch it and hold it at my side like a pinch
right.
block.
Yeah.
Then it got into wheelchair basketball, and they used to teach us you have to grab the whole entire rim. So you're grabbing the tire with your thumb, with the palm, and then grabbing the push rim with your fingers. And that way you got the most amount of energy out of that push.
Sure.
So even back in October, I was visiting my friend Ronnie, and we were working on some pinch stuff, and I was just holding a pinch and just one arming off of it. And he's like, I've been training pinches for like 8 weeks and I gained 5 pounds or 10 pounds. And I was like, oh yeah. And he's like doing his working weight, and I just picked it up one handed. Like it was nothing. I was like, yeah, that's just my warm up weight. And he's like, wait, what? And I'm like, yeah, that's just normal for me. So
do you train those strengths much? Like, you know, again, I'm kind of referencing some climbs that you've done where it's essentially, in fact, quite a bit of your climbing is heavily focused on upper body and campusing and this kind of thing. Like, I mean, absolutely incredible. I'm going to link to some of your videos, but it's really impressive to see the lock off strength, the campusing, and also the fluid and kind of the flow that you have with that.
Yeah.
Is that something that you train, or is it natural?
The fingers, like crimping, yeah, that was something I trained over years that I did. I started out hangboarding with repeaters, and then that got too easy. So I started doing repeaters with weight, and then that got too easy. And then by that time, like some of Tyler Nelson's work had started coming out, and I started reading some of his stuff and started doing progressive loading, started doing density hangs and stuff like that.
So like longer duration hangs?
Longer duration stuff. Yeah. Just because I weigh 100 pounds soaking wet. Like, it's not that hard for me to hang from 6 mils when you weigh 100 pounds and you've been training for 2 years on 20 mils for
right.
doing repeaters over and over and over again. I don't have to train finger strength as much anymore. It's more about trying to focus on the movement types. And I do so much board work between the kilt board and the tension board that, like, those shapes are just perfect for learning how to crimp and crimp strong. So I always had some sort of activation crimping and campusing just because of my style. So at a certain point after 3-4 years, I was like, I really don't need to train crimping. I don't need to train this type of stuff when I'm hanging off of the worst cramp on the kilter board with one arm.
Yeah.
Like that's, I'm like, okay, I think I'm okay in this aspect. I need to catch my legs up and catch my movement up and my sequencing up. So at a certain point, I just said, we'll do our density hangs and we'll do some repeaters here and there to make sure things are up to par. I have been training monos in a systematic way. Because there are some climbs that I want to do in the future that do require monos. So I am training monos in a systematic way. But otherwise, my hangboard training for myself lately has just been density hangs and just seeing how long I can hold on to. And I'm adding weight to my density hangs. That's not typical. I just don't weigh enough.
I was going to say, you just don't want to be hanging for 10 minutes when you can hang for 3.
Yeah.
I appreciate like the insight into a little bit of the training load there and how you weight things. How do you look at rest when it comes to your training? And essentially, how much are you training in any given week?
3 to 4 days right now, just with work and everything. And I'm going outside more too. So like 3 to 4 days in the gym, usually 2 days dedicated to rope training, 2 days dedicated to boulder and movement training. And when I'm doing rope training, I'm always putting on that forefront of like, how can I make my movement more efficient? How can I read these routes in a more efficient way? I still split up. I got advice in 2018 to split up routes into 3 boulder problems. And I've been doing that since 2018 and it's worked pretty well. I'm only memorizing the cruxes of each boulder problem and splitting it up into different resting on the wall. That's how I kind of sequence it up. But every day I go into the gym, I'm focused on specific movement types. What am I going to see? Where are the underclings? How do I stand up on my feet better? How do I continue some of this harder leg oriented movement? How do I like get into a tufa for like some side pulls? So those are the things I'm looking for. And like, I'll fall on those routes all the time and I'll just sit there and work it out and see how I need to work my body movement in certain ways. I was told by a climber back in Baltimore, Matt Bosley, he just said, at a certain point, you just build up so many moves. You start doing the same moves over and over again. It's just, they're smaller or at a worse angle. And you're just building off of that knowledge that you accumulated over the years. Because Boz can look at something and probably run up a 14 bolt-to-bolt pretty easily without having to really train super hard and just running off cruise control now. And so I kind of take that aspect in it. Like, I'm just putting more data into my brain. That's what I'm doing. Every time I'm on the wall, I'm putting more data into my brain. And I'm usually doing 2 days on, 2 days off, or 2 days on, 1 day off, just because right. Now they're changing up some rules this year in para, where we'll have our qualifier and our finals on the same day.
That's a lot of volume.
Yeah. So after nationals, I'll be tweaking my training program just a tiny bit to fit that sequence and that new line of rules afterwards.
Yeah, that's intense on the system. Well, let's talk about nutrition for a little bit here, and we'll loop back into technique and tactics, where I want to really zero in on footwork and some of these things a little bit more. But the next chapter up is nutrition. Is there an area here where you've struggled?
Yeah, I like donuts too much.
Oh, yes. See, I knew we were on a level, my man. I knew it. There's no struggle with liking donuts too much, Ben.
Yeah. Powdered donuts, cinnamon donuts. I eat way too much ramen for a professional climber, or not enough, depending on where you are in your career.
Yeah, exactly. That's a dirtbag staple.
I try and eat a lot of potatoes and vegetables. I know when Mansa is around, I'm eating more vegetables, a lot of squash, a lot of cabbage, and the stuff the Slovenes thrive on.
Oh, so Mansa's your girlfriend or partner?
Yeah.
Okay. So she's from Slovenia, Central Europe?
Yes. Yes.
All right.
She's from Slovenia. And so
yeah, very cool.
They're very heavy on their veggies. And so when she's around, I eat a lot of really good veggies and a lot of soups.
Carrots for power, veggies for power, this kind of thing. Well, that's good. Yeah. That's good for you. What about caffeine? What about alcohol? Do you have, you're drinking coffee right now, or I don't know, maybe that's whiskey.
Up to the imagination. No, it's coffee. It's coffee. I probably go to a pot a day.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's some caffeine. Do you use caffeine like before you train or before you compete?
Yeah, absolutely. Always. They haven't banned it yet.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a hell of a performance enhancing drug. Yeah. What's your routine like before a competition? Cause obviously there can be, at least for me, at least where I'm caffeine susceptible, if I take on too much, then I get jitters, anxiety, these kinds of things. And there's probably at a competition, that's probably already at a heightened level anyway.
If PhysiVantage has the no jitters in stock, I'll take that with me.
Crush. Yeah, I love that stuff.
I'll take Crush and I'll keep that in my bag. Usually some sort of espresso. I'll keep a spare Red Bull in the bag just in case if I feel like I've worn off on the caffeine and I need a little bit of an extra boost.
So you'll do that before a big workout or before a competition, just essentially to get zoned. Yeah.
To get zoned in. Always at least a cup of coffee or some sort of caffeine before. In February here, I'll start taking some beetroot extract, Cinderex. I'll be taking that to increase my blood flow so I can last on my power endurance and my routes a lot longer, just to get ready for the competition season. And so I'll pretty much have a cup of coffee before I leave, and then I'll have another one when I'm there, about 30 minutes out from full climb time. Typically, no more than 2 or 3 cups 30 minutes before.
What about food, like at comps or at the crag or during a long workout?
Dried mangoes and apricots.
Yeah. Love dried apricots. The texture is so good.
And nectarines. 2022, I got COVID between the Innsbruck World Cup and the Villars World Cup. And I basically lived off of nectarines and Red Bull.
Oh, God.
For that whole competition. And it worked. Like,
did you get second place at Innsbruck? Is that right?
This year, I got second place at Innsbruck, Villars, and Bern. The year before, I got first place at Innsbruck and Villars.
On nectarines and Red Bull?
Yeah, pretty much.
Shit. I mean, nectarines, Red Bull, and donuts. You heard it here first, folks. That is the champion's diet. Well, it doesn't seem like, you know, you're overly obsessed with the nutrition aspect, but you're trying to take care of yourself.
I'm always at a calorie deficiency. Just me walking every day I put myself at a calorie deficiency right off the bat. And it's just so hard to make sure, like, I'm getting in all the proper nutrients in. I try my best with my budget, try and make sure I get my proteins, my veggies. I drink a bottle of kombucha twice a week now, just to take care of my gut. And then that's about it. Whatever I can consume and make sure I can stay climbing, but yet feel light. I used to be much more rigid about it, but now not so much. I used to eat a lot of oatmeal, and then recently, within the last year, I found out that's actually quite horrible for climbing training.
Oh, interesting.
Because it already puts you at a calorie deficiency. They say oats actually serves no nutritional value, and you'll just have a huge glucose crash.
Interesting.
I have gone away from eating carbs for breakfast and trying to eat proteins and veggies for breakfast mainly.
Shout out to Scarpa, the official shoe sponsor of the Struggle Climbing Show, and my favorite shoes. Oh my gosh, I've been climbing in Scarpas for a decade, and I absolutely love the way that they fit and how they perform on rock and at the gym. The Instinct VSs have been a game changer for me, you guys, on the steep climbing that I'm doing over here at the Red. They just toe in and stick to everything. And also on the moonboard and the sets at the gym, I gotta say, I'm just able to move with such confidence and put more weight on my feet, which is such a good thing because my fingers are pretty weak and I can use all the help that I can get. So whether you're a weekend warrior like me or a pro like Sean Rabatou, Nina Williams, Nathaniel Coleman, Alex Puccio, Jordan Cannon, Maddie Hong, oh my gosh, what a team. Scarpa has got you. They've been sustainably making the best footwear for climbers, trail runners, skiers, and hikers since 1938. I love my approach shoes. I love my climbing shoes. And I think you will too. You can shop the whole collection over at Scarpa.com. Scarpa, no place too far. This episode is supported by Rungne, which of course is Magnus Mittbo's brand, and they make rad clothing and high-performance chalk at really affordable prices, you guys. I've been using their chalk Magdust for a while now, and it's awesome stuff. Whether I'm struggling outside on my project or struggling inside on the set problems at my gym, Magdust feels fantastic. It's been working great for me, it performs awesome, and it's affordable. It's at the top of a ton of best of lists. Loads of pros are using it. I think you're going to love it as well. You can score a bundle to keep your bucket or chalk bag full for an entire season, and it is not going to break the bank. Plus, right now, y'all, you can hit the link in the show notes for a chance to win a year's supply of Magdust chalk, plus all sorts of other cool discounts and prizes. It's all over at rungne.com, R-U-N-G-N-E.com. But use that link in your show notes because that's how you can score that year's supply of chalk. I want to shift gears here and talk about technique and tactics, which is like a really rich territory here for you. And I'll start where I always do. I think I know the answer, but where do you struggle when it comes to technique and tactics?
Placing my foot and keeping my foot.
Mm-hmm.
The placing's not so hard. It's whether or not I can keep it and keep that tension through the movement that I'm about to endure.
Sure.
Like I focus on a lot of rooting principles when I'm training, so that it just becomes second nature when I'm actually out there.
Yeah, could you explain that more? Because my footwork is terrible, and I'm always cutting feet and this kind of thing. So obviously, yeah, it's not apples to apples, but if something works for you, it would likely work for me. So how are you working on that? What is rooting?
Rooting is a way to imagine building tension from your feet, right? Every time you're placing your foot, you're placing an imagery, a little image in your head of your feet being like Groot from Guardians of the Galaxy and putting roots into the wall. So like every time you try and toe down, I'm imagining my feet growing roots so I can keep building that tension and making sure I'm pressing all the way through, activating every muscle that I can activate, activating that quad, that little bit of calf I get, some extensors, and activating my hamstring just so I can engage that much tension into it.
And you're practicing that on the wall. This is on the wall training.
On the wall, warming up. This is every time I'm on, I'm like actively focusing on it.
Mm-hmm.
Actively keeping my core engaged the whole entire time to keep my hips into the wall. Really focusing on a lot of time under tension principles. So like when I'm training, I'm making sure my whole body is like shifting the amount of tension that I need for every move. Just kind of like figuring out how to be the most efficient. And I think that's the hardest thing for a lot of climbers is like identifying those small muscle groups. Since I've had to deal with so much and had to tell people what certain things feel like, I'm so much more in tune with my body that I can work around that and activate those muscle groups a lot easier, at least the ones that have nerve endings to them. That also comes with a consequence too. When I'm trying to tell my right leg to like build tension and it's not building tension, I do get delayed neurofeedback, which causes headaches.
Interesting.
So if I'm like overemphasizing my right side and trying to communicate with my right foot, those signals aren't getting all the way back down to my foot. And then the signals get delayed later. And so they'll travel back up my nervous system and affect my head with some migraines at times.
No kidding.
That happened at year A, where like I was using so much of my right foot to like kick around and like place on mono points and stuff like that. It just overloaded. And by the time I got done, I'm like crawling out of my truck to get to my hotel room.
Wow.
Just about, because it just hurt so much.
Dude, how fascinating. Like getting delayed headaches from signals that you're sending. I mean, these are things that I don't think about. Most people don't think about. You think about something and moving something and it moves, but it's like essentially like hitting a traffic jam and then coming back up and then just hitting you in the head like brain freeze.
Yeah, it's like rubbernecking. It just gets slowed down. The traffic gets slowed down and then all of a sudden you're back at 65 and it just all comes back at a rush. And it took me quite a few tries to like get everything ready and good to go.
Dude.
So that's one of those things, like I got to be careful about how much I work and how much I'm cognizant of my movement types on the wall. And that's a big thing with technique, because I'm always looking down at my toes. So I'm always looking at the points of my toes and like testing my foot before I actually stand up on it. That's a big technique thing that I teach with anyone able-bodied or disabled, is making sure you're keeping your eye completely on your foot as you're moving it up and making sure you're testing that spot when you place it.
Yeah, I like
and
that.
That's a very simple drill you can do. And it just comes. Now I have to slow myself down when I'm instructing that, because I've done it so much in my own training that I'm like, oh, you're not looking at your feet. Why aren't you looking at your feet? Oh, I didn't tell you to look at your feet, type of deal. Mm-hmm. And that's one of those things that I'm really trying to emphasize on myself, but also emphasize with other technique teachings that I do, is like being very aware of like how you're placing your feet and making sure that it's actually on the hold.
I love the deliberate nature of that, right? Like seeing it, watching it, and utilizing it. But juxtapose that with what I also see in your climbing style, which is quite flowy and dynamic. It's not static. It's not like you're just kind of locking off one move to the next move to the next move. You really move. It's like, it's so engaging to watch you climb. So those two concepts almost seem like they're at odds, but maybe they're not. And can you speak to that?
No, they're not. They're not at odds at all. It's just like, you have to find your own type of rhythm. And like finding that flow for me came from wheelchair basketball. Because if you know the game of wheelchair basketball, and my specific role on my team was to create picks and create lanes so people can have scoring opportunities. It wasn't always me getting scoring opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
It was usually our bigger guys, because I worked so hard and danced around the court and danced around other people that I was able to help open up some opportunities for other people. And so like, I have to think about my flow state as moving like I was in wheelchair basketball, where it's just everything's just automatic and you just have this, you're going with the river type of deal. And that's how I visualize that before I get on the wall. And with all my deliberate things, my deliberate movements, I want to make sure that I am being as flowy as possible, even when I'm like deliberate, because that way it just makes your efficiency and your energy transfers so much easier. If you keep that momentum going and you don't have to stop the momentum pretty often, like I'm a steamroller. So once I get that momentum, I can't stop. If I stop and have to readjust, it usually means I'm at some sort of sequence or I'm just completely gassed. So the best thing for me to do is keep that ball rolling while I have that opportunity. Taking my musical background from like high school and adding it in with like movement types, just keeping that solid, fast flow. Like I listen to a lot of like metalcore and like Slipknot and stuff like that, where it's just like high beats per minute type of deal, but also there's just this flow to it as well. So I try and look at my movement as moving to some of those songs so I can keep a high pace and keep my efficiency up.
I really like that as just a training hack for anyone to try, because we're always at the gym with the earbuds in and that kind of thing, and essentially finding the right BPM for the pace essentially that you want to go on, and trying to do a move on the beat or keeping that rhythm, right? Because I certainly have a tendency to try to rest a lot and rest on a lot of things, and I end up running out of gas by the time I get to the top. And I've often been told by people who have watched me, like, hey, you know, maybe if you just climbed it a little bit faster, you'd have enough in the tank. And usually when I climb faster, I tend to get stiffer or over grip. It's not as kind of relaxed and efficient as when I watch somebody like yourself.
If you see me like at the top of a route after I've done that flowy state, I'm pumped out of my mind.
It just don't show it.
That's another mentality of, like, from wheelchair basketball, you didn't show your weakness when in wheelchair basketball. Like, wheelchair basketball is an ableist sport in itself, where you'll find the weaker guy or the more disabled guy, and you'll take advantage of him, especially at those higher levels.
Sure.
And it's on their team to work around that.
Yeah.
That's how that game works, is like, we're all put in this classification standard, and I don't let people know that weakness at all. I don't let people know I'm pumped. I don't let that come through, because I truly have to make sure it looks like it's the most beautiful fashion in the world. Like, I believe there was a video that Pete Whitaker and Tom Randall did a while ago where, like, Pete had to see how much he could crimp, and he like came off and he's, oh, that was so much. And just, it just looked like he just went, let go, and looked like there was like any type of struggle in that. And to be honest with you, when you're at that high of a level, you're not going to show that weakness. You're so focused in on how your body's feeling and the objective that you don't realize that you're still in a complete flow state. You're so in tune with that, you don't even realize you're struggling half the time.
Looking at the mental side of things, mindset, mental game, is there an area that you've struggled?
Initially, yes. This is also where, like, I excel, but it all revolves around making sure I have a certain amount of time to do rituals. You ever watch the old baseball movie, Major League?
Oh, yeah.
The scene where Wesley Snipes brings the bucket of KFC chicken to the voodoo guy, like...
Yeah, the voodoo guys out there, yeah.
KFC chicken before every game. That's how I like to look at my competition mindset routines, is I have a certain amount of things that I have to do the night before a competition and the day of a competition for me to perform well and feel like I have taken every piece of my responsibility into my own hands type of deal.
I like that.
It's making sure I'm the most prepared with, I brought my jacket. I have my team jacket. I have my lucky pants, my lucky socks. Yes, I do climb with my socks. Get over it. You want to crucify me on the climbing boards? I have poor circulation, so I'm going to pull the cripple card on that one.
Nobody's coming after you for wearing socks. You're out there absolutely crushing. And by the way, Tom Randall wears socks too, speaking of Tom.
I'm having relatively the same amount of food. I really love pad thai before comps and stuff like that.
So the night before, you like to have like the same dinner, the same kind of routine, so that you're...
Same routines and dinners and stuff like that.
And then what about whatever it is, 5 minutes before you tie in, what are you doing there to either get amped or to get calm? Like, what are you trying to do there?
It's a longer process than 5 minutes.
Okay, go ahead. Is it whatever your process is, dive into it.
I Wim Hof it the morning of. So I do one to two Wim Hof breaths and a cold shower.
Yeah.
Then I'll warm up the shower again, because my body doesn't actually, my legs will actually turn off if I do it too long.
Interesting.
So I'll make sure I have that cold resilience for a little while, and then I'll warm back up just for the sake of my blood flow and my ability to communicate with my legs. There's certain things I have to do with a foam rolling routine that I have to put in there. Then after getting warmed up and getting a pump in, I go back into a modified Wim Hof and just going into a very big mental imagery thing. I picture myself in a valley. Recently, it's been the Trenta Valley in Slovenia. It's one of my favorite places I've visited. Imagining the breeze hitting my face and my body and letting myself cool off on that. I'm listening to power metal the whole time.
So you're in a beautiful, serene, calm valley with the breeze on your face and you're listening to heavy metal.
Yeah.
I love it. I love the juxtaposition.
Power metal, Dragon Force and Dream Theater, stuff like progressive metal where it has like a little bit of like video game energy of we're going on a quest type of deal.
Yeah, cool. Okay. When
they clip me in, because we don't get the tie in for Paracomps, I'll do a quick modified Wim Hof where I'm hyperventilating myself a little bit.
So just fast breaths?
Fast breaths. To get all that oxygenated blood into my system.
Got it.
To delay pump. The whole entire point of that is to delay pump.
Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. Yeah, I've probably something I should explore. Like breathing super fast like that will typically get my heart rate up and get me amped if I'm about to like...
Yeah.
Punch into a crux or something like that. But it also will help to delay pump because you're oxygenating the blood more.
Yeah, you're oxygenating the blood. You're
cool.
You're tricking your brain into thinking you're about to die to a degree.
And you really are, basically.
Yeah. And you're trying to like, it's a way for me to trick my brain into thinking that, hey, we need some extra adrenaline right now. And this is a time to go. I take a nice deep breath out. I have a physical cue with my hands and after I've chalked up of a clap, and then I smile because you always have to have fun while you're climbing. So I do the clap and smile and then I go. Nothing stops me after that. Once that clap and smile is done, nothing else matters in the next 30, 40 seconds.
God, I love that. Thank you for walking us through the full routine there because yeah. I love getting that window into your life, but also that you have these triggers where you're like, okay, now I'm doing this. Now this takes me into this. And then like the clap and the smile and then boom, it's go time. Like you are on that route and you are trying hard and you have quite a reputation for being very driven, very passionate. Like you care and can get upset as well. And I'm curious as we're into the mental chapter here, what the pros and cons are of being so driven, so passionate and caring so much about what's happening there on the wall.
Definitely has caused some blow-ups before in the past. There have been times where I did not do as well as I thought I did and have gotten bumped off the podium where I did need to walk out of the gym for a little while that I wasn't around people. There have definitely been times where I've thrown shoes into a fence and all that lovely stuff and really trying to control that anger.
Mm-hmm.
That you get from you put so much work in for a whole entire year and you come up short. I definitely had a reputation of being a poor sport at times because I just put that much effort into my whole entire year for few competitions a year because para, we only get what at most 7 comps a year, and that's including locals and all that stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot riding on each one.
Yeah. There's a lot riding on each one. So we only get a few opportunities a year to show what we're made of. Yeah, I definitely have a reputation of not being cool at times. Over the years, that has calmed down quite a lot. I take it better now than I used to, for sure. There have been times where I've been with Mo and I got kicked off the podium. And she's like, you good? I was like, I'm not talking right now. She just lets me be. But there's also been times where I've been didn't hit podium and I still showed up. I still care. I still came to things.
Have you ever wanted to quit?
Yeah. In 2021, I was training so hard and with the pandemic going on and getting ready for Moscow, I was training in isolation a lot. Just so I didn't want to risk COVID, didn't want to risk anything. I just wanted it so bad. And all that stress came down on top of me. And I think we were a week or two out before Moscow. And I just was like, I just want to fucking quit. I don't want to do this anymore. Like my best friend and training partner ended up a month and a half before I left for Moscow, moved to Canada because he got married. And was able to enter the country. And that was like his second or third time trying to enter Canada. And he had left. No one had the schedule to go train when I could train because people had school or work. So I was like going into the gym early in the morning and then working from like 12 to 10 every day, basically. And yeah, very lonely time. And it was Matt Bosley. He's just like, dude, it's okay to want to quit. Like the comp scene can be rough at times. And he like legitimately took a day. He just had his assistant setter set everything one day. And he just claimed with me one day just so I had somebody that was checking in while I was training. Because I would go in before the gym would even open and go in and get my work done and then go and clock in for work because I worked at the gym that I was training at that time. And it was a very lonely experience for that time.
Thanks for sharing that, man. Just the loneliness of being a competitive athlete and having a lot riding on what you're doing and your performance and not having maybe the support network around you. This gives us an opportunity to talk about community and mentorship. You've had mentors. You mentioned Ronnie. You've mentioned Mo. You are a mentor for climbers out there. What does community mean to you as a climber?
It's everything, honestly. For a long time, before I met the paraclimbing community and got integrated into that, I was doing a lot of climbing with just normal gym bros in the gym, just only bouldering, not really wanting to expand my knowledge upon bouldering. I just wanted bouldering to be the thing.
Sure.
And after I met Ronnie and Mo at the first ACF in Horse Pens, I kind of was like, okay, what else is here? How do I get involved in competition? Because I had this competitive mindset, like from wheelchair basketball through my whole entire life, just wanting to be a highly competitive person. But as I went on in the community, I realized that competing wasn't everything, and getting to learn new skills and coach youth was really kind of a realm of like, hey, these are the things I learned in my competition circuits. This is what I've learned in what I've done for myself. I just want to pass along to you. That way you don't have as much of a learning curve ahead of you.
Mm-hmm.
And so I always wanted to get back to at least the youth and then get back to the paraclimbing community because I do coach some paraclimbers. I do hang out with a lot of different paraclimbers throughout the country. And the things that like Ronnie has done for me and the things Mo has done for me and my friend Kyle have been some of the biggest things I could ever ask of people. And if I didn't have this paraclimbing community, I would have never had my best friends, the support system that I do have, or even met my fiance. So it has literally given me everything. Yeah. Gave me a job, gave me a career. It's still a struggle.
I appreciate the struggle over here, but that's beautiful. I do think that there's something incredibly special about the climbing community and how supportive we can be and how a passionate group climbers are. Even at the highest echelons of competition, there's just so much camaraderie amongst competitors. So it's beautiful to hear that that's been your experience. And then you've also taken that and passed it on from what I've seen as you've now, you conduct clinics at ACF, you're a mentor, you're a coach. So how have you taken that feeling of community and what you've been on the receiving end, and how are you now passing that on to the next generation of climbers?
I really just look at what I wish I would have known when I started, like some of the technical skills. Like, I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to project anything harder than 512 or whatever grade you want to put in there, and like really save people the time, the trial and error time, because everything in disability is trial and error, anything, especially inside of adaptive sports. And so, let's try this and see if it works. Let's try this and see if it works. And when you have someone that has gone through it before and did the trial and error, they can save you a couple steps and save you a couple experiments here and there and be like, hey, try this. This is what really worked. This will help up some of your training philosophy, this will help up some of your psych in certain ways because you're not going to hurt all the time. Or this was a quick shortcut that I took to get to the point where I'm at. And so once you get there, keep building on to that. So that's the philosophy that I take. Anything that I learn, I just want to make sure that I'm sound in that skill. And then I want to give it back to the community. That way they can skip all the steps that I had to skip. Because I went through the competition. I did outdoor. Then I did the competition scene. Now I'm like transitioning between like outdoor and indoor all the time. So it's like helping people find what they really love about rock climbing and have them stick to that in the best way possible. Whether it's I need more skill to learn how to project a route bolt to bolt, or I need more skill to learn how to do an on-site format comp. Whatever it is, I want to take my knowledge and what has helped me and pass it along to other people. That way they can have a more enjoyable and more prosperous career than what Mo had, than what I'm having, than what whoever the next person is going to come. I think it's really important to just give back to the adaptive community, but also make sure they know it does come with work. Still have to come up with your own way, your own style, your own process. But these are just some of the tricks that have worked for me.
Yeah. And in doing that, like you said, it could make the road a little bit easier to get into the point where they can develop their own style. And is the goal for you and Mo and some others to essentially help to create the next generation of climbers who are going to be surpassing you all in your accomplishments and achievements and take the team to the, you know, the next level?
That's the goal.
How's it looking?
At least on my end, the next person coming up is on my tail. He does still need some work with head gain, but the person that's right behind me is only 19 years old, 18 years old, something like that. And he just needs a little help tweaking some things, but he'll probably surpass half of my accomplishments by the time he's 25, when I really started getting into my accomplishments at 25.
Right. That's how it goes, huh?
Yeah. And so I would like to break some more ground before he starts doing that, but
for sure,
definitely already seeing that, especially in the competition realm. The outdoor realm is all over the place because so many people have so many varying styles and they want to do so many different things. Like, it's not just people achieving Mo's like 512, right? There's so many paraclimbers now that are out there that already climb 512 and climb it efficiently, pretty efficiently. It's finding the 513, the 514, the 515 paraclimber, not just the V10 paraclimber. It's the V11, V12, V14 paraclimber.
Yes.
If it's even possible.
What are your goals as a climber outdoors?
V12 for boulders.
Sick.
I have a few in my eye that I want to get done in the next couple of years, and at least 14B. It's maybe action direct if I'm feeling spunky in the Franken Euro 1 year.
Dude, so, I love it. What about at the Red River Gorge? We got some stuff out here for you.
Pure imagination.
I mean, that's all time.
Yeah.
14C.
14C. Supercharger I've looked at.
Sick.
I'm projecting Maisie May, the 13.
Yeah,
that's
cool.
My supercharger. That's my project there. And then the other 14 that I would love to do is not at the new. It's not at the red. It's in Little River Canyon. And it's Southern Comfort.
I love those goals. Those are sick goals. You just named some of the all-time routes. And no doubt you can achieve them. Are your outdoor goals at odds with your comp goals? And how do you juggle those?
Basically, most of my projecting time is dedicated to 2 weeks in the spring and whatever time I have left in the fall after comp season.
It's not a lot of time.
It's not a lot of time. Last year, I did try and project some routes in Slovenia, in the Koper area. I still have my eye on those. So I do have some time in the winter to work on those, but once it hits January, considering paranationals are in March, I don't always have. I have about 8 to 12 weeks to train for any given comp. Then I take 2 weeks to deload or go outside and do whatever I want to try. Once the comp season's over in August, September, I usually immediately start training for Sen season from October to November.
Yeah.
Depending on the weather conditions. It's really December is the only time I get a real legit break, but this year I started ice climbing. So, I mean, that's a different process. That's more of like my thing that I'm psyched outside of like trying hard is I like going ice climbing and like having fun in that realm and challenging myself in different regards there. But I would most likely just keep it to like ice cragging rather than full on albinism.
Well, I mean, the photos that I saw, little clips that you posted from Ouray were so cool, so sick. Dude, what a joy to talk to you. I'm so motivated by your work ethic, by your passion, by your style, and also how you're giving back to the community. This has been a real treat.
No worries. Thanks for having me on, Ryan.
All right, that clips the anchors on this episode with Crushing Benjamin, a guy that is indeed crushing it on plastic, on rock, and just within the climbing community here that we all love so much. If you want to get psyched, check out his Insta feed at crushing_Benjamin, and you're going to see some pretty incredible climbing, as well as, by the way, a video that he just posted at Nationals where he displays that final part of his pregame routine, the clap and smile. And speaking of smiling, man, I'm smiling right now from all this bonus footage. I just dropped a bonus episode with Ben that's available right now to patrons and subscribers. And in it, he shares some takeaways from bouldering with Nathaniel Coleman, what it's like to campus able-bodied climbers projects. I love that one. How he trains endurance on the kilter board, an easy drill that we can all do at home to build contact strength, and so much more. You can get instant access to all of that right now at zero cost with a free trial over at patreon.com/thestruggleclimbingshow or right there in your Apple Podcast app if you're an iPhone person. And you'll also, by the way, get instant access to more than 40 hours of other bonus content featuring Adam Andra, Chris Sharma, Nina Williams, Alex Honnold, and so many more, plus the pro clinics that we've done on Stronger Fingers with Dr. Tyler Nelson, Advanced Bouldering with Allison Vest, Moonboard with Ravioli Biceps, and Performance Hacks with Hazel Finlay, just to name a few. It's all there for just a few bucks a month or zero cost right now with a free trial, so you can check it out. Thank you so much for supporting the show if you can. I'm working really hard for you here. Huge thanks and appreciation to our show sponsors who have brought you this episode at zero cost. Check your show notes for links and special discounts from those guys that are only available to Struggle listeners. And also you can see all of the show's brand sponsors and special deals by just popping over to thestruggleclimbingshow.com/deals. The Struggle is carbon neutral in partnership with the Honnold Foundation. Awesome. This episode was produced and hosted by me, Ryan Devlin, and The Struggle is a proud member of the Plugtone Audio Collective, a diverse group of the best, most impactful podcasts in the outdoor industry. You can follow along with the show on YouTube and Instagram at The Struggle Climbing Show, and you can also shoot me a note there. I'd love to hear from you. I hope training and climbing are going awesome, and if you're struggling like me, well, at least the struggle makes us stronger.